It is a condition of contemporary life in Canada. We live indoors. In fact, in our modern non-agricultural societies, we spend upwards of 90% of our time in one building or another, and we consume a lot of energy. Heating, cooling, lighting, and running our homes, offices, stores, and factories. Can we do a better job of that? We'll find out next in part three of our special series from the Equinox Summit on the Future of Energy, live from Waterloo, Ontario.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
And we welcome you back to the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. Founded by Mike Lazaridis, the inventor of the BlackBerry. It is home also to Neil Turok, one of the world's top cosmologists, and this fall to distinguished research chair Stephen Hawking, one of the world's most acclaimed scientists. It is also the host, along with the University of Waterloo, of this week's Equinox Summit, a gathering of thinkers, analysts, policy experts, and representatives of the energy industry, and their task is to come up with a blueprint for a low-carbon, electrified future by the year 2030. And hi again, everybody. I'm Steve Paikin, and we are happy to have you back for day three of this Equinox Summit, our coverage, incidentally, which extends well beyond what you see on television. We are streaming this broadcast live and the entire Equinox Conference on our homepage. That's tvo.org/theagenda. Our good pal Mike Miner is up at the top of the hall tonight. He's moderating a live chat where you can log in and join the conversation. Again, that's on our homepage. We're also on Facebook, isn't everybody these days? Facebook.com/theagenda. And we would enjoy it if you'd send us a tweet and give us your thoughts about what's happening tonight. You can do that at twitter.com, hashtags your agenda or Equinox Summit. So lots of ways for you to get involved in tonight's broadcast throughout the week, in fact, where we are going to be here at the Perimeter Institute all week in Waterloo. Tonight, we're going to focus on how we keep the buildings we live in and work in lit, warm, or cool on days like today, and efficient. And joining us to do that, Kathy Foley. She is chief in the Science, Material Science, and Engineering Division of the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization. That's Australia's leading science research agency. Maria Skylas Kazakos, Professor Emeritus in the School of Chemical Sciences and Engineering, University of New South Wales, Australia. David Keith, Canada Research Chair in Energy and the Environment from the University of Calgary. And then the folks we like to call our local talent. Jatin Nathwani, Ontario Research Chair in Public Policy and Sustainable Energy Management and Director of the Waterloo Institute for Sustainable Energy. And Terry Meyer Boak, she is Professor at the School of Architecture at the University of Waterloo. And as I welcome you all here for tonight's broadcast, I guess we should say this is a fairly timely program because we learned today 73,000 people in the province of Ontario are without power tonight because in a corridor between Barrie, Muskoka and Kingston, Belleville, they have had high winds, they have had lightning strikes, and they have had hail. So the power is out. Do we care about this topic? I should say we surely do. Now, before we start imagining a more efficient future of energy, we've got another one of our handy-dandy video background pieces, so Michael Smith, if you would, roll tape.
If coal is the fuel burned in a power plant, fully 65% of the energy is lost right at the source. Another 3% is lost during transmission to your home. Of the energy that does reach the light bulb, almost all is wasted as heat. Less than 2% of the original energy from the coal is actually converted into light. Right now, the world is struggling to produce 22 trillion kilowatt hours of electricity each year to power almost every aspect of our lives. By 2030, we could save more than 50% of our CO2 emissions just by plugging the inefficiencies.
Okay, two things to follow up on. First of all, that video really does indicate how inefficiently we seem to use so much of our energy in this country and around the world. And the second thing is, ever since this conference started, there has been a significant disagreement among many of the participants with some of these videos. That video suggested we're using 22 terawatts of power, 22 trillion watts of power around the world in terms of energy usage. Most of the people here say 15. The fact is, I guess, there are going to be disagreements because many people don't agree on how you should measure energy usage. We can get into that a bit tonight if you want to. But before we do that, let's put some more facts on the table here. Michael, again, if you would. By the year 2040, two-thirds of all the people in the world will live in cities. Today, urban areas account for about two-thirds of the world's energy use, and that will reach almost three-quarters by the year 2030. A couple of more facts for you. Currently, residential and commercial sectors are responsible for 41% of energy usage in the United States and almost a third in Canada. All right, right off the top here, let's get into some discussion. David, we'll go to you first. We see how inefficiently we use power. What effective, immediate measure could we undertake to make our homes more energy efficient right now?
I think it's the basics for homes. It's better illumination, so better lighting, better insulation, and better heating systems.
Better lighting means what?
Better lighting means lighting that uses less energy, which doesn't just mean the light bulb itself. It also means the fixture that holds it. People often think only about the light bulb, so they assume that CFLs or LEDs, these compact fluorescents or LED bulbs, are necessarily better. They are better, but put in the wrong fixture, they're not better. So it's the combination of fixture and design that makes lower energy lighting.
Terry, one thing we could do to make our homes more efficient immediately.
Well, I think a lot of what we have to deal with in Canada is a cold climate, and so we have to make our buildings more conservative and able to keep the heat in the wintertime without losing it. So that would include better insulation levels. Some people would say to go to a low-carbon building, it could be up to two times current levels, which...
We'll follow up on what a low-carbon building means a little later.
Okay, yeah. But and the other one would be windows. So right now, most people would have double-glazed windows. We should be going to probably triple glazed, in some places quadruple glazed, double coats of low E. That would be really important.
That's a good start. Jatin, you want to add something to the list?
Yeah, before we go to what technological fixes or mix you can put, better homes, better design, smart grids, and so on, the one key point I would like to point out is you, the consumer, the occupant, and your active engagement in how you use energy within your home and, of course, wherever you go.
So use
is
less.
Central. By engagement, I mean your desire to think clearly about your actions that either result in lower or higher energy consumption. So you are a very serious part of that equation before we surround ourselves with the right set of technologies, and we can discuss those.
Okay. Kathy, you're from Australia.
Yeah, that's
how,
right.
How long did it take you to get here?
Oh, about 24 hours,
24
I guess.
Hours to get here. Yes. Well, you know, of course, our country is beset with climate that is very extreme.
That's
very hot
right.
In the summer, very cold mm-hmm. In the winter. How is it where you are?
Well, we have very hot summers, which are then frequented by what most people say are really cold winters, because we don't have very good heating in our houses and they're not built for cold weather, but they're actually not built for hot weather much either because most people in Australia want to own their own home, and so they'll do anything to, you know, buy that quarter acre block of land, put a house on it, but by the time they bought the land, because it's pretty expensive, they don't have much money left for the house itself. So what do? They build the cheapest house possible, and it's usually, you know, almost like sticks with a few boards on it and a crummy tin roof, and so you can imagine it's pretty hideous. And as a consequence, they put lots of air conditioning and stuff attached to it, and it just buzzes away, using up lots
of
energy.
So this all compounds to the inefficient use of energy that
Absolutely.
We're beset with.
Yeah. However, I think in my own case, the worst thing is my children. They've got no concept of what it is with I think if they had the chance, they'd have the air conditioner on to something like to 16 degrees Celsius, and then they'll feel hot, so they'll put the heater on to maybe bring it back up again.
Now, wait a second. How do the children of the chair of the leading scientific agency of Australia not know about energy conservation?
Well, they... I'm just a parent, too.
Maria, go ahead. Finish the list, if you would, for us.
Well, I just wanted to follow on from Kathy. In Australia, our buildings are so poorly designed, and even simple things that we could do, just putting awnings over the windows in summer to stop to shade all that westerly sun that comes in and just heats up our houses. Even the orientation of the buildings, we don't seem to orient the houses so to make the maximum use of the light that comes in. So we, even in the daytime, sometimes we have to have the lights on because everything's in the wrong direction. Putting things like simple short-term solutions that we've already started to implement in our own house, in fact, just putting shutters on the outside of our windows. It costs a few $1,000s, but you know, perhaps the payback won't be all, that great. But these are short-term things that we could try to do, because I think I mentioned before that in Australia now, in Sydney, we have this smart meter where if we use electricity between 2 and 8 p.m. at night, we pay 40 cents a kilowatt hour for that.
So 40 cents, that's a lot.
Enormously. Mm-hmm. So we can't, last winter we had a very cold winter, and we waited until 10 o'clock at night when the cheap electricity comes in before we put our heaters on. So we thought, this is we froze. So we put the shutters in and things like that.
Gotcha.
So
David.
So you started asking us about a lot of technologies. Mm-hmm. And all these technologies are wonderful, or not every one, but there's lots of things we can do. But just making efficiency technologies that could potentially make buildings use less energy doesn't necessarily result in less energy use. So for one thing, we have much more building area per person than we used to have. Mm-hmm. And as people introduce more energy efficient technologies, one thing that happens is that people end up with bigger buildings. So this isn't necessarily a bad thing if people are made happier by bigger buildings, but we shouldn't be naive about assuming a simple link between technologies that are potentially energy saving and actual energy savings.
Understood. Jatin.
Steve, I just wanted to bring on this thought or idea. You, your castle, your home, your degree of self-importance, your who you think you are. By you, I didn't mean you, but I mean we ourselves. It's all so tied up in our self-image. And your home is that extension of yourself. And now what have you got in a home? You've got pipes and wires bringing in energy, of course, for your comfort, security, and so on. And the range of technologies that you can bring to bear, better building designs, there's whole issues around smart devices and your ability to control your own energy use, and all these thoughts and issues and that are behind.
Does that really work? Do smart meters make people smarter about their power usage?
Well, the point I was just about to make is that the most central component of any smart grid or smart anything is actually the occupant. And if you miss that point, doesn't matter sophisticated technology and better house design that you can bring to bear, but you could undo all that advantage of desire to move towards an energy efficient home and reduce
it. Can I jump in there? Because one of the things with the workplace, we now have, and at least in Australia, and I'm sure you have it here in Canada too, an expectation of zero harm of people at work. And so when we go for safety in the workplace, we expect, it doesn't matter how stupid you are, that we have systems in place, even though there's signs up that says, don't go into this room because there's no air. People will still go in and surprisingly die. And so therefore the law tells us we have to have stupidity interlocks, which means that even though someone can't read or chooses not to, they can't get in there unless there's oxygen in there. You were just saying that humans make that, with all the gadgets in the world, we still will make decisions. I'm just wondering whether there's the potential in the future of us having gadgets that actually, it's almost like, HAL in the Space Odyssey, which says, no, you can't open that and take over. It's a little bit,
This is 2001, the Space Odyssey.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. I would go to say that one of the biggest problems we have is human behavior, and the behavior that has come to depend on gadgets. So before we had electricity and thermostats and that central little thing on the wall. I remember as a kid, mom and dad would set it back at night to save money, and then, mom would get up in the morning and she'd put it up so that we'd all get out of bed. But now we've got the one that's all programmed, and someone in the house is the geek and they program it, and then everybody else just stops. And the only thing anyone does is in the summertime, from winter to summer, they switch it from heat to cool.
Right.
And then they switch it back. And what happens is that people don't know how their house works. They don't know where the sun is. They don't know what the weather's like outside. And they don't realize that there's probably, even in our climate gets very hot and very cold, there's probably 4 months of the year they could have everything off and they could be bothered to open the windows and shut the windows and open the blinds and shut the blinds and disconnect from the grid for heating and cooling because we really don't need it.
David, why do we never think of this stuff? We don't think of this stuff.
People don't want to.
People
are
lazy.
Truth is, I grew up in a family of energy geeks, and we were very careful about shaving the energy use of our home, and did actually by a factor of two. But most people don't think about it, and they don't want to think about it. They want to think about who they're having for dinner or what TV show they're watching.
That's true. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about high IQ buildings if we can. Kathy, I'll go to you first here. There are smart meters that we've been talking about, but then there are also smart buildings. What would we do to make buildings smarter?
Well, that's a really good question, because there are, of course, lots of things you could do, from smart metering, which says, I guess it gives you some feedback so that you know if I am doing things like turning on every possible electrical appliance, whether we're using a beautiful sunny day and we're putting all our washing in a clothes dryer, it's sort of somehow or other is able to let you know that that's maybe not a good idea. You could have things which are in there to make it smart. But in reality, I guess it's all about having sensors that allow you to sense something and therefore take that and make it into information that allows some other thing to happen to mitigate whatever it sensed. I mean, that would be what I would see as being smart. But I don't know that that's really realistic. I would imagine it adds a cost to things. And probably it's more passive approaches that's going to make a difference. And I think you look like you want to say what those passive approaches are.
I was going to let you finish.
Oh, right. Yeah. So, but there are numerous passive approaches, from just the first thing is making sure you design the building well and then all use the right sort of materials along the way. And I suppose the other is having the built part of our environment and the things like the energy and the water that we bring into it, that they're appropriately, I guess, optioned up so that they actually are fit for purpose.
Gotcha. Jatin,
so
you want
building to... Building on more or less the same point, but the idea that if we bring in, let's call it smart devices that give you real-time feedback control, so you're aware, the tools are there for you to be aware of your energy consumption. Let's say you have that available. Now, some people may choose to be indifferent to that or not. And beyond bringing that level of awareness through the right tools for you to react to, that you can almost also go the next step where the devices automatically can control and exercise certain options as you may have preset them. So this is what you call set and forget kind of proposition. Mm-hmm. So you don't need active intervention on your part every moment to say, well, I better turn off the light and so on. So there are a number of approaches that you can think of that will do that. And beyond that, of course, building designs and so on.
Maria? Yeah.
Well, I think things like that can be probably too expensive for the individual house, but certainly for the workplace where we have a lot of fairly expensive buildings, and just simple devices like sensors that can, in fact, even in our laboratory, we've got this super duper system where the light goes on when you enter the laboratory, switches off by itself when you exit. The same in the lecture theatres, they switch on when they know that the lecture is about to start and switch off. And if you go over time a few minutes, you end up in the darkness because so it gives you a good incentive to finish on time as well.
Yeah.
So. So a lot of smart things that could be done to make sure that we don't waste energy.
Okay, Terry, you used an expression earlier about carbon neutral design. Tell us what that means.
Well, a low carbon or a carbon neutral building is designed to use no fossil fuels, and so you have to design a building that is very conservative, very tight in terms of its energy requirements, which means going back to the idea of good design, so that you can power everything that you use in the building with renewable energy, be that photovoltaics or wind. It could be from a combined heat and power plant that could be on the building or a community shared resource, so that you do not end up purchasing any fossil fuel to use. And so that requires really good design of the building in terms of like a tight building that doesn't require an awful lot of energy in order to power it.
Who's doing this well?
I would say there are very few true carbon neutral buildings out there. There's probably about 20 or so in the United States. There's some in the UK.
Is there one we'd know? Is there something iconic we would know of that's a carbon neutral building?
Well, the probably the most famous one in the U.S. is the Otto Leopold Center in Wisconsin. It's LEED Platinum, carbon neutral. They designed the entire building, which was quite an interesting proposition. They had a budget for PV, which was $250,000 U.S. They had their own forest, so they selectively took the wood from the forest. They had a pile of logs. They milled them. They showed that to the engineer. They said, this is what we have in terms of our structure. They said, this is how much PV we can have, and therefore the building has to be able to work with these two components. And they designed a beautiful facility that totally balanced everything out.
Let me hear David and then Jatin on this as well.
I think we've been talking all about smart buildings, but we need smart policy. So one thing is we need policy that actually pays attention to what happened. A great amount of government policy in buildings has been what engineers call open loop, where we propose a policy that gives a subsidy for what have you, insulation or lighting of some kind, and then we essentially don't measure the results, or we overinterpret the results. So a lot of money gets spent and we don't know what part of that money actually is cost effectively helping drive down energy use and which isn't.
Well, do you want to take the real example, the real day example?
Here's a classic example. The Canadian government introduced a policy to try and push people to use compact fluorescents, and they estimated in the official budget, actually, I had a whole bunch of students look at it, how much energy it would save. And they neglected a basic fact, which is big chunks of Canada, especially Quebec, are hydropower heated. And a hydropower heated building, making a more efficient light bulb actually does you no good at all in the winter, because the heat's going into the building anyway, so any amount you save in the light just goes on in the furnace. Zero. So they actually turned out, we estimate, overestimated the energy, the carbon savings from that policy by about a factor of 2. Mm. And so that's not, I mean, picking on a particular policy, but the broad thing is, we've made this all at the level of individual buildings, but we need smarter collective policy and policy deals with the bulk of buildings. So individual things like the Otto Leopold Center gives you this idea of where we could go, but we're not going to build all buildings that way. And if we want to make deep cuts in the actual emissions from the building stock we have on a time scale of a few decades, we need to think about a lot of stuff that's not very sexy that you can actually apply across a big chunk of the building stock.
I feel like just polling the audience on this, because I try to follow this stuff, but I got to confess, I've never heard of this building in Wisconsin. Can I see a show of hands here? How many people have heard of this Leopold building in Wisconsin that is carbon neutral? Okay,
right.
Hardly any hands are up in the house right now. Until they build one of these buildings in New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles, I got a feeling no one's going to know about it. That's fair to say, isn't it?
I would say that's true, and I think there are huge barriers to doing this, and part of it is the reporting back. There are an awful lot of innovative buildings, high-performance buildings that are using all sorts of different strategies to reduce energy. There's a lot of money poured into this, and we never get to hear back how those buildings are performing. So we don't have post-occupancy results on most of the buildings that all the eggs are in these baskets. And then either the clients don't want the information released because they could be embarrassed if it's not working up to the potential, or the architects and engineers also would like to bury the results because, again, it's not working up to potential. And to me, this does a huge disservice to the planet, because we need to know what is working so we can build on that, what's not working so we can...
Jatin.
So I was going to actually give you two examples. One is called Passive House in Germany, and the other is called Active House in Denmark. And I don't think the passive house actually really makes it zero carbon neutral. I'm not sure on that. It's an efficient home. Active house comes close. But the point I wanted to build on was, though your home, beyond the design and good design, let's call it, for it now to emerge and turn into, in essence, you become a generator. So, you know, the solar roofs and geothermal and so on. There's a range of control technologies that you can bring into play that, in fact, shutters that move up and down, and there's a whole range of controls that you can bring to make a home much more effective, but again, only if you want to.
I want to just look at the monitor here on the floor in front of you all, because I'm going to ask our director, Michael Smith, to put up this picture. Go ahead. This is the cold carbon neutral building.
That's the Otto Leopold.
And that's the one, is it?
That's it.
Okay. That's the Leopold building in Wisconsin.
Yes.
Would this work as well in Arizona as it would in Wisconsin?
Absolutely not.
It wouldn't.
Because there's a different climate, and one of the key factors that we have to look at when we design buildings is they have to be climate responsive. So we have to look at specifically things like the heating degree days versus the cooling degree days to see the severity of the climate and completely adjust our designs to suit that climate. Okay. So we have to have very, very different buildings. Even across Canada, if you have high areas of humidity versus in the Arctic where you have low sun angles, and some of the prairies where it's very dry, we have to design our buildings differently in order to respond to the climate and to the sun angle, so that we can take advantage.
You speak of design, and David, I want to ask you about something that I suspect more people have heard of than this building in Wisconsin, and that is LEED certification, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. If you're a hotshot architect nowadays, or you know a builder who cares about the environment, you want to get your building LEED certified. What do you think of that?
I think, in general, the idea of a certification program like that is very good. But we've done some look working with architects at how well the LEED standard reflects and incents some of the behavior that we want. And the answer is not so well. Now, this isn't big knowledge that people in the middle of the LEED standard know that, and they're gradually changing it and improving it. But the current LEED standard actually does a pretty weak job reflecting kind of carbon efficient design, and it gives particular incentives for things like you saw in that Leopold building that the LEED people think are good but aren't necessarily good. So why do we have solar on roofs, right? So first of all, solar PV is extremely expensive right now. It may get cheap, it's very important potential, but even if we have cheap solar PV, do we want it in roofs where it's very expensive to maintain in the real world if we really want to get commodity power, or do we want to have it outside and use the grid, which is very efficient? That's a choice, and LEED is effectively built in a bunch of choices like that that are not obviously the right answer just because the community who did it assumes they're the right answer.
Maria, you want to take that on?
Yes, I did actually, because obviously if we're looking at retrofitting houses to incorporate photovoltaics, it's a big initial investment. But I was very impressed many years ago. Back in 1993, we were collaborating with a company in Thailand that had a vision for the urban house, and they packaged this whole a building design which had solar panels on the roof, and they were planning to also put the battery in the garage to be able to capture the solar energy and use it at nighttime. And when I was questioning them about the cost, and they said, cost isn't an issue. If we package it as part of the total house design and you package it and sell it to the customer, they don't even see what the individual components are. But of course, there is some sort of maintenance cost built in, but all houses have maintenance costs. Mm-hmm. So I think it's the way we approach things. I think retrofitting is certainly not a good way, but when we're looking at building and designing new houses, I think that's where we need to sort of, especially when you're paying a huge amount of money for the land.
For boutique clients of fancy buildings, but if we want to make a big bite out of energy use, we have to get everybody's building, including people who are scraping by. And we can't impose huge costs on them, and we do have to think about cost efficiency. Mm-hmm.
And if I may to add LEED or energy storage and various ways of the performance over the last however many years, 30 years, has not been all that great. And I'll give you one good example, written up by David Mackay in his book, Sustainable Energy Without the Hot Air. This is at Cambridge University, so they've designed one building with all the fantastic new energy efficiency perspectives in mind, design and so on. And then they looked at the energy consumption in that house, in that building per square meter use of energy and so on. And then looked at number of buildings that's next door to it, built 30 years ago, absolutely zero eco anything in mind, and looked at the energy consumption in these things, which were supposed to be, let's call it bad buildings from the earlier era. And the energy consumption was not all that much better in the new design. It was better, but it wasn't a substantial margin. And if you look across at the literature, you're looking at perhaps 20-30% maybe improvement, and it's not all that spectacular is all I'm trying to say.
A simple fact, the energy performance of buildings, LEED buildings, is only very weakly correlated with their LEED rating.
Well, and part of that has to do with the only about 25% of the LEED credits are in energy optimization. And there have been studies done that show that most of the people that go for LEED will go for the easier credits than the energy credits. Now, I think that when LEED was created, which was in the mid-1990s, this was before The Inconvenient Truth and Al Gore, and it was about a holistic, sustainable design. So it wasn't targeted at energy efficiency. It was targeted at materiality and sustainable environments and sustainable sites and interior comfort. And so it's a very broad-based idea to change and transform the market. And there it has succeeded, but for energy, that's not what it was designed for.
I just want to give Mike Miner the heads up. We're going to come to you in just a minute, Mike, and find out what's going on online. But Kathy, I wanted you to speak to the cost angle, which is, you know, we've heard here in Canada, yes, get those photovoltaics on your roof. It, you know, it'll pay for itself in energy savings over 20 years. But how many people are going to be in there? I mean, the house will be around for 20 years, but the people who will realize the savings won't be there for 20 years, and so there's not much uptake.
That's a really important issue you raised. And in fact, it goes back to what David was saying too, is that most people actually don't earn a lot of money. I mean, it's I think most people live hand to mouth, and the idea of having a requirement because society wants us to have energy efficient houses because of things in the past which has led to us having a society where greenhouse gases are getting out of control and we've got a potential of climate change, or we're experiencing climate change now. That is putting a huge expectation on people who just frankly probably can't afford it. You know, do you have food on the table and clothe your kids?
Although we just saw an email come up on the screen a second ago. It said people are very happy to pay lots extra for a marble countertop in their kitchen, but not to put solar tiles on their roofs.
Well, that's true. That's where I was going to get to our government policy. And I think you really aren't going to or will not see things happen unless you have really sensible policies. But as David was saying, that if you have policies that aren't then measured and checked on, because I would imagine it's pretty hard to get it right. It's anyone who's had anything to do with government or even planning anything, which requires implementation by a range of people, you know you're never going to get it quite right, and you've got to sort of somehow niggle your way through or modify it as time goes on. But if you don't even measure to see whether or it's doing what you think it is, and look at the unintended consequences, you're going to be lost.
Let me jump in here for a second, folks. We'll do a little business with the people at home, because we want to remind everybody that we are at the midweek point in our week-long series of programs here at the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics in Waterloo, Ontario. We're watching a lot of very smart people from around the world gather here in Waterloo for what they're calling the Equinox Summit. They are trying to write up a blueprint for a smarter, more efficient use of energy, a blueprint for policy towards the year 2030. Because as all the videos and all the experts suggest, we are potentially going to double our energy usage on this planet over the next 20 or 30 years, and we can't keep going the way we're going. Go to tvo.org/theagenda, our homepage, to learn more about the summit, to join in our web chat, to watch the live stream, or coverage of the entire conference. There are a lot of terrific and fascinating speeches that take place, presentations during the course of the day. You can catch it all on our website. And while we're having this conversation here, it's happening online at an undisclosed location. No, wait, actually just up there in the top of the hall. Mike Miner is standing by. He's moderating the online chat. Mike, what are folks saying?
There's a lot going on online up here. People are sharing links to various carbon neutral buildings, a lot being shared about different techniques and products and things they've tried themselves. One person said that in the middle of the program, she went and turned off the lights, so we're making a difference. But they've been talking about how much they think about energy conscious changes to their behavior. And the way it often comes back, Harmit said, yes, I'm always thinking of ways to save money. And it's really coming at it from that economics background. One person pointed out that the 100 years of abundant energy is kind of the exception in human history, and she thinks that people can come back to using less pretty easily. During the winter, she says it's tundi. People should realize it's normal to wear sweaters and slippers instead of bare feet. We don't have to live in saunas all the time. And the other thing that they're talking about is how do you get people to change their behavior? There's a lot of confidence here that changing the price and policy can get us there. Thirsty Mind says that behavior changes with price, that we need to change the price signal by implementing carbon taxes, and the market innovation will follow. Some people are even more enthusiastic than that. Gina wrote, I want a carbon tax with an exclamation point, and then she waxed nostalgic for Stéphane Dion. So that's the type of community we're living in right now.
Okay, Mike, thanks very much. Keep moderating away. I just want to say, actually, for the people in the hall here, I'm sure you figured this out already, but on the big screen up above us here, Michael, grab a shot of that if you can, the tweets, the emails, the online conversation, that's all happening here. So in addition to following the dialogue here on the main stage, as it were, we also see the people doing that as well. Let me also keep the shot like that, if you would, for a second, Michael. I want to try something. We haven't done this in our 2 days previously, and Kevin, who designed the set here, assures me that we can make some fancy stuff happen. We're blue right now. Can you do something with that? I'm just wondering how smart the set is, that's all. Can you change it from blue to something else? I'm just curious. Because the guy who designed the set swore that we could.
Technology always works.
How about this? I guess we can't. No, now, Kevin, you promised me that if I asked for a set change, you would show that it could be done. But David is right. Technology always lets us down in the end, doesn't it? And here I was.
Oh, wait a sec.
Like most technology, a little slow, but eventually it gets there. Okay. We're purple right now. I'll take that as a victory. Okay, we've talked smart houses, we have talked smart buildings, let's talk smart cities. And to that effect, I want to talk about Fujisawa, Japan. Small place about 40 kilometers west of Tokyo, they describe themselves as a fully integrated eco-town by the year 2014. That's what they are aiming to be. They have a development of 1,000 homes that will be built to be more energy independent than any other modern town through an integrated smart energy and smart grid system. And the aim is to reduce energy, produce solar electricity, and use battery storage in each home. And the town says it can reduce its CO2 emissions by 70% from its 1990 baseline. Maria, is this the future?
Well, that's the future I would like to see, definitely. And there are a lot of development companies in Australia that are proposing these sort of developments. And if you start with a clean piece of land and design the whole system really well, and you integrate the solar into the building, and with batteries, you don't even have to have the battery in each individual house. You can have a central battery system which can actually store the energy from each of the houses, and you could have a metering system that can, you know, meter the usage of the stored energy as well. So I think, you know, definitely this is the way we need to go to develop small communities which can really totally disconnect from the grid.
Jatin, presumably it's easier to start from scratch as opposed to retrofit an existing community in this way?
Absolutely true, and the key two points that came across on that the community that you just described is this notion of integrated amongst different sources and how you bring the so-called smarts into it. And actually here in Ontario, we're well ahead. I mean, people have made criticisms of smart meters and so on, but the concepts behind that is not just smart meters, it's this whole evolution moving down the path that begins to get sets of solutions integrated into both our homes and our businesses and move down the path that gets you to ultimately your desire to be both an efficient home, a lower cost home, and lower carbon footprint for that matter.
David.
Let me try and weave together two threads, the carbon tax thread and this one. The outcome I want, I think we all want, is a society that has a smaller environmental footprint, zero carbon, fine. But what that policy is effectively doing is saying, we know the answer is standalone homes that aren't grid connected. Well, maybe. Actually, I think connectivity is great. I don't see that as the right answer at all. I see it as a technology forcing answer that may really spend a lot of money that we could much more effectively spend elsewhere. And the hard, cold fact is right now in Ontario, solar PV is well over $1,000 for every ton of carbon you save. There are innumerable things we could do much, much more cheaply than that to cut carbon. So this isn't saying solar PV is bad. There are certainly potentially great things about it. But the advantage of something like a carbon tax is it says it's not the government's business to say what the technology choice is. That's people's business. It's the government's business to say what is the social good, which is, in this case, less carbon emissions.
Do you get the sense, though, that this is too complicated for Mr. and Mrs. Everyday Ontario, and we just want you to make the decision for us?
No, but the brilliant thing about carbon tax or something like it is you just see it in the prices. Once you've taxed carbon, all people do is think about what they think about anyway, which is saving money, and they don't have to think. I mean, there's no way you want every citizen thinking about all the details of their home. You want them to think about saving money, and you want to impose prices and design standards and architectural standards that help make society have a less footprint.
Okay, well, let me ask all of you again once more to look at the monitor here on the stage in front of you. And Terry, I'm going to ask you to sort of do a play-by-play for us here, because we're going to look at three different significant cityscapes. There's the Chicago skyline. And flip it over, Michael, to the next one. That's in Toronto. That's the RBC building in downtown Toronto. And then, Terry, this is a picture I think you took in Berlin, Germany.
It's the GSW headquarters, and it's a very thin plan building that is trying to take advantage of natural light. They have policy in Germany for office buildings that prohibits anybody sitting more than 6 meters from a window. So instead of having deep plans and needing a lot of artificial lighting, they should be able to light with daylight for all of the daylight hours. And on top of that, there's natural ventilation requirements as well. So you see in the previous building, which was the RBC building in downtown Toronto, they're using differentiated facade design. So that if you're facing south, there'll be shading devices to keep the heat out. And if you're facing north, you don't bother with them because it's not required. There are a certain number of operable windows. And that allows a building, if the power goes off like it did August a few years back, that everybody doesn't have to ditch work and take a few days off because they'll die.
So can I, wait a sec, can I just make sure I understand that? There are windows in skyscrapers
that
you can open?
Yeah. And one of the advantages on the GSW building, which is a double facade construction, because if you open a window on a skyscraper and you have sensitive papers on your desk, you just might not want them flying out to the street. So one of the things that they've done with the design of these facades is a kind of a buffered system so that the wind isn't coming directly in, but it's circumvented, but it still gets in and you get fresh air change. It also cuts down on the downtown noise, so you don't have acoustic problems. And there are ways to close some of the vents and open them so that if it's a busy traffic, like up till 10 in the morning when you've got cars going by and you've got exhaust, you can shut them so you're not sucking that bad air in.
I do want to follow up on that with Kathy, though. What do you think about the notion of having skyscrapers where you can open the windows? I'll follow up in a second, but let's start with that.
I guess the first thing I thought was I hope everyone loves their job and their life, because open windows in skyscrapers can lead to suicidal tendencies.
But the double facade really does help, that helped, I sort of thought,
thank goodness. But look, I know in my own laboratory at CSIRO, people hate being in rooms where there is no window, and in fact, people work best when they've got a window. We have, even if it's a window onto a corridor, we have a clean room where people gown up to make devices, and we put big windows in the clean room, because we found that when you didn't have a window and you're working in this closed-up room, people actually had high levels of mental illness and distress and anxiety. Just by putting windows in and just seeing people walking by, it reduces it completely, and it takes it away as a health and safety issue for the workplace.
Are these designs prohibitively expensive, though?
I don't know about the cost of that sort of building. That was what I was looking at before, was thinking the aspect ratio is almost like a carbon nanotube in a building. And it's so I'm curious to know, too, if you had a cyclone through, would it actually knock it over?
What's really interesting to understand about buildings, and a lot of this goes with cost, and whether it is an owner-occupied building, which that one is, or if it's a commercial building like done in North America, which is flipped and it's tenanted, that 80% of the energy that buildings use is operating energy, and 20% is embodied energy. And over the life of a building, the cost of, say, the structure over 50 years might be less than 0.6%. And changing the envelope would be a certain additional percentage, because they refresh them every once in a while. But if you can design a building whose envelope radically cuts down the requirements for the operating energy, then you're in the chips not that long down the road. And with energy prices only going up, then it's a win-win situation in the long term.
Well, we did see that, actually. One of the silent tweets that just came up while you were talking, the poster suggested, the only education people need is the size of their energy bill. I mean, there is a certain amount of truth to that, isn't there?
Definitely.
Well, that's what they're doing in the United Kingdom. In Britain, they have an energy labeling requirement for buildings, for houses, for commercial buildings, and you are rated from an A to a fail down at the bottom. And so when you sell a building, you have to have an energy audit done on the building, and it's labeled, so the person that's purchasing the building knows where your house or commercial property sits, as well as the potential, the easy potential for improving that to a better, if you did a quick renovation or put in extra windows or something, that you could improve it. And so, I mean, it's a little bit like the LEED rating system that labels something platinum, gold, silver, or bronze, or certified, that if you start to sell buildings and you come up to the building and go, oh, well, this has got a D minus rating. Wow, that's going to cost me a lot. I don't want to buy that building. Whereas the one down the street, the energy bills and the audit prove that it's a B rating with a potential to an A, that's a much better investment. And so that's, you know, starting to confess about the buildings, and it's required by policy there, and it's a pretty effective way to put that on the table.
I was going to say that that's actually one of the things I was thinking before when we're talking about energy bills and all that, is the potential of introducing a business model which has got innovation in it, that is coming up with a very different way of thinking of how we pay for things, so that it's and I know if you look at some of the most successful businesses, from whether it's iPhones and Amazon Books, they apparently have very different business models that has allowed their companies to be very successful, and it's completely unique, and maybe that's the sort of thing we have to think about.
David?
Cost alone is certainly not going to magically decarbonize our economy. We have energy is now a tiny fraction of GDP, a few percent, and it's going down, not up, as a fraction of GDP. And we have gigantic carbon emissions that are rising. So the idea that the problem will just kind of solve itself with growing energy prices, I think is
well. Is don't you think if you trebled or quadrupled the price of heating your home, people would use less and then put a sweater on more?
Treble or quadruple is a very big number. We have to focus on what the problem is. If the problem is carbon emissions, let's focus on pricing carbon, not energy. They're not the same thing.
Okay.
Because the issue is we can either cut in the home or we can decarbonize energy upstream.
Jatin, you wanted to
add? There's actually a fascinating counterintuitive paradox here. We make buildings leak tight, let's say, for energy efficiency. And it's the increase in cooling load, the air conditioning required now. So you've got a tight system, you cannot open a window, and the air conditioning load continues to go up, and we're beginning to see enormous implications for energy use, both in North America as well as all around the world. So the way you design your building and what it will or won't require in terms of cooling load has enormous implications, and that's beginning to be...
Okay. Maria, somebody asked at one of the sessions today, I guess at the morning session today, whether we ought to start designing our cities with the certainty in mind that we're going to go from 15 trillion watts of power usage today to 30 trillion soon, and whether we fundamentally need to kind of ratchet down our needs and our expectations.
Well,
what do you
exactly.
think?
Exactly. In fact, that's why I wanted to just ask why it isn't just the carbon footprint. It is our total energy consumption that we need to bring down. And I think we all agree that if we can reduce our energy consumption, then we may not need to build as many additional wind farms or solar farms or whatever else that we have to build to provide the energy for the developing countries as they continue to grow and develop into the future. So we need to cut our energy consumption, not just our carbon
footprint. So, David, here's the problem with that then.
Yeah.
Here in the province of Ontario, most of the energy we use is generated by OPG, Ontario Power Generation.
Yep.
They're in the business of selling us power. They want to sell us more power, not less power. How do they pay off their stranded debts? How do they grow as a company? How do they do what they do, while at the same time encouraging us to use less of their product? Seems like there's a built-in contradiction.
There sure is. And there's lots of ways in which we have to do a better job squaring that circle and try and fix perverse incentives. And that I completely agree. But I don't agree that we necessarily want to reduce energy use. Energy does all sorts of wonderful things. And it's especially odd to sit that sink here when there's a billion people who lack basic access. We have real problems. Climate is one. Air pollution is another. Land use impacts of energy are another. We need to focus on the problems we actually have. We don't have any fundamental shortage of energy, and there's not some sort of theoretical reason we should use less energy. Let's focus on real problems we have today and deal with those.
That's on you. Okay, let me hear from Terry.
It's a global problem, and we're all on one planet. And the problem right now is that China is outstripping us in construction. And we all know that they're really good at making knockoffs. And they can make A-grade knockoffs and B and C, and if you buy the wallet on the street, you know it's a D-grade knockoff, and the A1, you won't be able to tell the difference. The problem is they're knocking off our buildings. They're knocking off our lifestyle. And there's a lot more of them, and they're ratcheting it up big time.
What do you mean they're knocking off our buildings?
They knock off the what it looks like. It looks like one of our skyscrapers. So they want that look, that appearance. And so they build it as they build it. And it's not built as well. And it's not built to the same standard, and it has the look of one of our buildings, but it's not performing like one of our buildings. I mean, Canadian construction is world-class construction. Even our housing is wonderful in terms of its efficiency. After the 1970s and the oil crisis, we're exemplary. But what we have to do with our buildings and our attitude towards our very consumptive lifestyle is to cut it back, because we can't say we can just keep doing this. We have lots of power.
Well, David just did.
Well, I would beg to disagree with that, because then everybody else is entitled to do the same thing.
Okay, Jatin, what do you say?
To make the disagreement perfect from across the floor, I'm with David on this, but in the following way. I think we underestimate the improvement to our quality of life that energy provides. And having said that, it doesn't mean we should go on a tear to continue to expand energy consumption at a very high level. But this simple-minded view that cut energy consumption down, first, how do you do it in a society where consumer sovereignty kind of prevails?
So are you calling your colleague from Waterloo simple-minded? Is that what you just did?
Would I ever do that?
No, but why do we have to be wasteful with the energy?
No one's advocating wasteful.
No one's saying we should be wasteful. Yeah. We're saying we should focus on the problems that are the actual problems. And energy per se is connected with lots of problems, but if we just focus on energy, we won't effectively tackle the problems that are actually killing people and changing the planet.
Okay, with a few minutes to go here, let me put one more thing on the table, and that is, you did so much work in Germany, we're going to stay in Germany. Another aspect of new smart technology involves turning our homes into energy generators, not just using the power, but also sending it out as well. Michael Smith, last graphic if we could here. Freiburg, Germany. A development in this Black Forest town produces 4 times as much energy as it consumes. And the secret to Freiburg's success is, you've heard of this in Ontario, the feed-in tariff program, the FIT program, where anyone generating electricity from solar, photovoltaic, wind, or hydro gets a guaranteed payment of 4 times the market rate. Okay, this program, you know, is remarkably controversial here in the province of Ontario, but here's someone else, Kathy, who's doing it, and they seem to be having good success with it. Is it a good idea or not?
Well, how do you measure success?
Yeah. And big buy-in?
And who is, if that's true, but who's subsidizing it? And therefore, and I would imagine it's the government that is subsidizing it. So what aren't they doing with the money that they should be using,
so
maybe in hospitals? Or look, I don't think it's sustainable. And I think it might be a way of, sort of an entry approach to try and get people to be turned on by it. But it creates then false expectations, so that people start planning for something and saying, well, I'm going to do this, that, and the other on my house. And then just as they're about to implement it, then suddenly the tariff is turned off and people just go back to the way they were.
But philosophically, David, isn't it a good idea to get homeowners thinking about being generators of power as opposed to just users of power, and in our case, probably wasteful users of power?
No, I don't think we necessarily want to make power on people's buildings. Making power has lots of environmental consequences. It's not clear it's easier to control among people's buildings. We want to focus on the real problems we have: air pollution, climate, land use. And to do that, we have to accurately target those problems. And these feed-in tariffs that are extraordinarily expensive and have had remarkably little impact in terms of really cutting emissions are cost ineffective. And we have a big enough problem. Remember, for the climate problem, we don't want to make a 5% cut. If we want to solve this problem, we have to cut to zero.
Right.
You don't have to do that by efficiency, because you're not going to cut energy use to zero, are you?
Jatin,
so, as simple as that.
I think I'll agree with David again on this point, and I would be only supportive of feed-in tariffs if first done right, and that if it would promote innovation so that you actually eventually would get down to a lower cost structure.
But if the idea is to shut down coal plants and replace them with renewables that you encourage through a feed-in tariff, how can that be bad?
Well, there is a point to be made that at some point you could provide that level of incentive, and there are other ways to do it. Feed-in tariffs is one, and if you want to try and move down the path. But if you do a complete open-ended feed-in tariff that has all manner of downstream consequences around consumer cost impacts and so on.
Maria, how could it be bad? With the same amount of dollars spent, the German government could have cut much more carbon emissions many other ways.
20 seconds left, Maria.
But I really think that wasn't the whole point of it. They weren't trying to cut down emissions. They were trying to stimulate and kickstart the PV industry. And I think they were probably successful from that point of view. A lot of companies started up, and they started up a new renewable energy industry with a lot of new jobs.
But that's because they knew what their motivation was.
And that's what their motivation was. Not
we mix up. What are we trying to achieve?
Yeah.
Exactly.
But we still have to. We still have to design the buildings better.
Sorry, Terry. We have a so says yes. The architect. That's true.
Because otherwise, the PV will never be able to power.
Maria's supposed to get the last word. That's our tradition here. She did it last night and tonight again as well. Anyways, guests, thank you so much again for coming from fairly near, in the case of two of you, and a very long way, in the case of two of you, and a pretty far away, in the case of a fifth of you. Audience, thank you for taking time out of your schedules to join us tonight, and we hope that you found the trip down to the Perimeter Institute worthwhile. For more information about tonight's guests and the entire Equinox Summit, visit our homepage, that's tvo.org/theagenda. Tonight's program was produced by Vodek Schemberg and Sandra Jonas and Allison Buchan-Terrell. And you can read Mike Miner's post with videos and motion charts on world leaders in renewable energy. And guess what, folks? Canada's not in the top five there. We got a lot of work to do. That's on our Inside Agenda producers blog, also online at tvo.org/theagenda. Now, please stay with us. We're going to take in just a moment a look at what we've got on the program tomorrow night, and hopefully the set will change color on cue tomorrow night. We'll do it right after this.
Raising a baby on the streets can be a cryptic blessing. In a community plagued by drugs, poverty, and abandonment, silver linings don't seem obvious. Follow the intense personal journey of a street teen's venture into motherhood. What does it take to end a vicious circle of despair? See the amazing power love can have over the most extreme circumstances. Don't miss Children of the Park, tonight at 9 on TVO.
The Agenda with Steve Paikin is presented by Ontario's 33,000 chartered accountants, public policy leaders since 1879. More information is available at casforchange.ca. And by contributions to TVO by viewers like you. Thank you.
And that is The Agenda for Wednesday, June the 8th, 2011. Tomorrow night, energy, geography, and politics. As the world's population swells to 9 billion people, the question of who has energy and who needs it may be the defining geopolitical issue of the 21st century. Hope you can be back with us tomorrow night for that program. I'm Steve Paikin. Thanks for watching TVO, for joining us online at tvo.org, and we say goodnight from the Perimeter Institute in Waterloo, Ontario.